you only need that screen.
You don't need the screen?
Yeah, because I'll change that as a board. What's better, guys? What screen without screen?
It's
better. It's better? Okay, great. Legally dead, as is the case with brain death,
but the family may be a religious family, doesn't necessarily have to be an Orthodox Jewish family, but there are Orthodox Jewish families who would not accept the brain death criteria as halachic death, and they would wish to continue care of this patient. So generally in the United States, that care would be allowed to continue. But for a physician to say, for a patient who is breathing, albeit with the assistance of a respirator, and has a blood pressure, that they want to stop all care against the wishes of the family, nothing like this has happened so far in the United States. So this is something which has been battled in the courts in Baruch Hashem. The judge, at least at this stage, has allowed the care to continue for this particular individual. And also, just to give you an idea of how commonplace, it's not like I just see these shadows all the time, and I don't talk to these shadows, and that's I don't consider myself in any way, shape, or form posing, but I am often involved in these cases for consultation. And just this week, I had two consultations. The one consultation was from a family who, Baruch Hashem, the people are healthy, but the woman is getting on in years, and it was suggested to her that she fill out a living will. And she wanted to fill out a living will in consonance with halacha. So she consulted me about what the halachic issues would be about how to fill out a living will. And the other issue was a case that came from the Midwest of a particular man who was suffering multi-system failure, who was an elderly man who had his kidneys stopped functioning, his lungs stopped functioning, his heart stopped functioning, he was connected to a breathing machine, he was connected to a tube which was providing him feeding, and the question was, how many of these things need to be continued? Can one possibly stop some of these treatments? If yes, you can stop these treatments. Which treatments can be stopped? And I consulted on that case. And we will discuss exactly these kinds of issues today in the hopes that you will gain, by the end of today, a better understanding of both the medical and the halakhic issues that relate to the treatment of patients at the end of life. Now, feel free, by the way, if you guys have any questions, feel free to interject. Both the questions you want me to address that I may not address, or clarifications of halakhic issues or medical issues, don't hesitate to interject. So here are my objectives for our session today. One is to understand the medical issues that pertain to end-of-life care. Two, to appreciate the medical and cultural milieu in which medical decisions are made. And this is as important. You have to understand the society that you live in and the way society today deals with patients at the end of life, and it will be very instructive to you how physicians address patients who come into the hospital for end-of-life decision-making. And three, to facilitate sakhalapa for end-of-life issues. Baruch Hashem, you have a lot of Kabbalah poskim here within the halls of the Yeshiva University. And parenthetically, I just noticed that the Rav Schechter has on yutorah.org, just very recently, January of this year, 2008, Chester has a lecture up on yutorah.org on end-of-life issues, where he discusses so many of the issues that we're going to be discussing today. So, Baruch Hashem, from Sak Halacha, you have people to turn to here in your own institution. My objective really is to flesh out for you the medical issues and the basic halachic issues, so you'll have a much better idea how to approach Sak at the end of life. The topics that I'm going to be dealing with are the following. One is DNR, DNI. Does anybody know what the initials DNR stand for? What does it stand for? Excellent. So we'll discuss that in a little more detail so people understand. I want everybody to understand what these issues are. Number two is the general withholding of care. Number three is coma and PDF. Does anybody know what the initials PDF stand for? PDF stands for persistent vegetative state. There was a famous case that you... may recall of the Terry Schiavo. I don't know if that name rings a bell with any of you. We'll discuss that kind of circumstance today as well. And the next entry is the nutrition and hydration. And perhaps, I wouldn't say the most, but a very common consultation for the rug is whether one should provide nutrition and hydration at the end of life. And this is, again, a very complex issue. Disconnecting a ventilator, active euthanasia. Active euthanasia means actually administering a medicine, a life-ending medicine, much like a fellow by the name of Jack Kevorkian did and was put in jail for in Detroit. He would administer potassium chloride individuals who came to him, and his sorrow, by the way, is an interesting sorrow. We can talk about his sorrow, how he tried to be exonerated for his heinous crimes, but it didn't work, and he ultimately went to jail. And next is the doctrine of the double effect. The doctrine of the double effect we'll talk about in more detail when we get to that section, but it involves the administration of medicine such as morphine, and that medicine morphine can have two effects. It can alleviate the pain of an individual, and it can also potentially end the life of the individual. We'll talk about in the world of the medicine in the halls of the hospital today, how is this administered, in what kinds of circumstances, and of course, what the halakhic issues would be relating to the administration of morphine in these particular cases. So we'll begin, as we often do in the world of medicine, with a case study. And here's our case study. Mr. D. Cone, 66 years old, is a chronic smoker and was recently diagnosed with non-small lung cancer. He has completed chemotherapy with no improvement, and further therapy is deemed futile. He now presents to the hospital with shortness of breath. The hospital staff asks the family if they're interested in signing a DNR order. The Cohen family calls the rabbi and asks, "Rabbi, is it okay for us to sign a DNR? Is DNR something which is halakhically permissible?" And I hasten to add, at the bottom of this, the rabbi then calls the doctor to discuss the case. What is absolutely essential, if you take home one point from this afternoon's discussion, that point should be, when you're posting these kinds of issues, you have to be in dialogue with the physician to understand the medical realities of the case. So again, the physician doesn't expect you to be to have a medical degree, but at the same time, there are certain basic facts about prognosis and about the diagnosis of that particular individual, which will be absolutely essential for you to render an appropriate stock. So for you to get the information from the family is not appropriate, because oftentimes the family, in their times of distress, are simply incapable of integrating the information the physician tells them. They are often misinterpret the information the physician gives them. They will not be relaying the information accurately enough. Yes?
He sends them more to consult with the physician.
Right, physician in charge of that patient's care.
Not a person shouldn't say, "Oh, I know so-and-so, he's a good doctor, and so I'll call him and ask him about."
Right, now, in many circumstances, speaking to a proven doctor can help you get a general understanding of the medical issues. It won't help you in this particular case. It won't help you with the facts of this case, which are essential to posting this particular circumstance. So you may choose to consult with both. You may speak to the physician. The physician may tell you things that you don't completely understand. Then you'll go to Shul the next day and say, "No, Dr. Goldstein, I was on the phone with the physician about a particular case. He said this and that, and I don't really understand what he meant. Can you please flesh that out for me, help me understand it?" But to render stock, and keep in mind, this is truly end-of-life issues. This is mamish life or death. It doesn't get more serious than this. I mean, this isn't happening, Milton Blatchett's kashrus issues. This is, you want to make certain that you're posturing this very appropriately, and I know you all take this look to be as serious as it deserves. So it's worth the investigative effort, the dialogue with the physician, and you'd be happy to find that in many cases the physician is willing to discuss it. So even case in point, this case that I mentioned that I was approached with this week from the Midwest, I asked them for the number of the physician, and I spoke to the physician at length. The physician was, gave me all the necessary details to assist them as best as I could. Yeah.
Just a dumb question. Does the doctor have to share information with the rabbi?
Excellent question, and not a dumb question at all. And in fact, in the world that we live in, and this is a relatively new development, there's been a backlash about the confidentiality issues in the medical world. And, I suspect you haven't heard this term called HIPAA, which is the acronym. I don't even know what the acronym stands for myself, but it relates to the requirement that physicians are completely confidential in their dealings with family members and non-family members. But if the family gives the physician the permission to speak to a rabbi and divulge that information, it's perfectly okay. So if you call without the family's permission, a physician may indeed give you a hard time about divulging information. But if it's clear that this is a necessity for the proper treatment of this patient, the physician will divulge all the necessary information. But your point is very well taken. I deal with this issue on a daily basis because I practice emergency medicine. So there isn't a day or shift that goes by that somebody doesn't call on the phone about a particular patient. And I'm pretty limited about what information I can call and to whom I can call in patients. Your sensitivity is very well placed. So let us first discuss the medical reality. What does do not resuscitate mean? What does do not intubate mean? We'll deal with that issue first. So do not resuscitate, patients have what's called a do not resuscitate order. What it technically means, definitionally, is that if an individual, Dr. Shalom, has a full and complete cardiac arrest, which means his heart stops beating, and he has flat line, you know, asystole, no pulse, normally what physicians would do is they would perform CPR, and they would use medicines, electric shock, chest compressions, in order to attempt to resuscitate that individual. That's what's called resuscitation. If someone wants to sign a do not resuscitate order, that means that in the event of a complete cardiac arrest, no resuscitative efforts would be initiated. The person would be allowed to pass away. Just parenthetically, there are interesting halachic shilas about the person's flat line and the doctor resuscitated. Is that considered kiyasamesim? Can he go back to living with his wife if he's flatlined and is resuscitated? The issue was discussed more extensively with the cardiac transplantation when they put the patient on cardiac bypass so that the blood of the patient isn't running through his own heart, it's running through a machine. And there were shadows whether he was considered a mace and comes back and has a mace. So those are interesting issues. But for our purposes today, do not resuscitate means that a person is signed an order that if they have a cardiac arrest, you would not resuscitate. Now, what is the difference between do not resuscitate and do not intubate? What does intubate mean? To intubate means to place a plastic tube into the mouth of a patient, and that plastic tube goes through the mouth into the trachea. And we'll show you a picture in a short while, and that plastic tube is then in turn connected to a machine which delivers oxygen to the patient. That is called intubation. That is putting that plastic tube down into the oral cavity of a person to allow them to receive oxygen and breathing artificially through a machine to which that tube is connected. Now, the reason these two are dissociated from each other is because even though many times we intubate patients during the course of a cardiac arrest, there are many circumstances where an individual is not in cardiac arrest yet and is just deteriorating, and in particular this case where a person has lung disease like lung cancer or severe emphysema or severe asthma, there may be a circumstance where you would want to put them on a breathing machine when their breathing is so bad that they can't breathe sufficiently for themselves, and that would require intubation even though they're not in full cardiac arrest at all. So in certain circumstances, so someone, let's say, comes into the hospital and they're having great difficulty breathing, you have to decide if you will put them on the breathing machine. Now, what is the problem with the breathing machine? What is the perpetual fear of every human being, most every human being? Their fear is that they're going to be connected to a breathing machine, they're going to be unconscious, they're not going to be able to communicate, and they won't come off the machine. And they will live the rest of their days, weeks, months, connected to a machine, unconscious. And they perceive this as an absence of dignity, a lack of dignity in their in the process of their death. So almost invariably, there's this perpetual fear, especially in the older population who are sensitive to the inevitability of death, being connected to a breathing machine, and I'll get to your question in 1 second, and not being able to be disconnected from that breathing machine. What they don't often realize is there are many circumstances when you can be connected to the breathing machine. The breathing machine can do its job to treat a pneumonia, to treat fluid in the lungs. And then after the treatment is completed, the breathing machine can be removed. But unfortunately, physicians don't always know in which circumstances it'll be required to be maintained indefinitely and in which cases it can be removed. And it's that dilemma which physicians and patients often find themselves in dialoguing about these issues. Yes.
Does the patient feel conscious for the intubation?
No. For the procedure itself, sometimes many times we'll give them some brief sedative so we can perform the procedure with minimal discomfort. But after the procedure itself is done, they can be completely conscious. Completely conscious, interactive. And the breathing machine is used for a very wide variety of medical cases. It's not just people that are literally on death's door, that are in the intensive care unit. It's used for a wide variety of diseases, and the overwhelming majority of times, these people are intubated and then extubated subsequently after the treatment is completed. Does DNR mean DNT? Here's the cultural milieu issue, which I need to apprise you of, because this is absolutely essential. In the culture that we live, there is a major thrust for withholding care, for non-treatment, when you go into a hospital. It seems rather ironic. But especially when elderly, debilitated patients, or nursing home patients, or non-verbal patients come into the hospital, the general assumption is that they would not want their care continued because their quality of life is too poor. And it's often an assumption that the physician makes for his or herself on behalf of the patient, not necessarily the patient's belief. And there is literature, let's see if I can find that literature here, that once a patient is made a DNR, that the physicians treat the patient differently. They say, not only will I not resuscitate him or her if they have a cardiac arrest, but when they say do not resuscitate me, that's basically a code word for saying, you know, I've had enough, my life is not worth living anymore, and maybe stop more treatments, not just cardiac resuscitation, but maybe I don't want feeding, maybe I don't want antibiotics, maybe I don't want blood transfusions, maybe I don't want surgeries, et cetera, et cetera. And there are interesting studies about how physicians and healthcare staff treat patients who are DNR. So the effects, this is from the American Journal of Critical Care, the effects of do not resuscitate orders on the nursing care of critically ill patients. It showed that nurses reported that they would be significantly less likely to perform a variety of physiological monitoring modalities, like blood pressure and the pulse and things like that, for patients with do not resuscitate orders than for other patients. So there's a psychological change, switch that goes off when a healthcare team knows that a patient is do not resuscitate, even though it may not be appropriate. So you could have someone who has completely treatable conditions can come into the hospital and leave the hospital. But the person just says, if I have a cardiac arrest, which is a pretty extreme thing, which doesn't happen too often, then I don't want to be resuscitated. But it doesn't mean I don't want to be treated with the full capability that medicine has to offer. So that's a major issue in the hospitals that we operate in the United States. The effect of DNR orders on physician decision-making. The effect of DNR orders on physician decisions to provide life-prolonging treatment other than CPR for patients near the end of life was explored. The presence of a DNR order may affect physicians' willingness to order a variety of treatments not related to CPR. So there's just the psychology. If a patient, you know, if a doctor is working with a patient, the patient says, you know, I don't want to be resuscitated, the patient's thinking, you know, maybe he doesn't want me to be aggressive in his care. But the fact of the matter is that's not necessarily true. Yes?
Is that effort in the medical world to recognize that psychological reality and sort of change the subculture on it?
There is no push to change that subculture at all. Zero. That's the reality. It's interesting. There may be, but to be honest, everybody seems pretty comfortable with it. Change evolves from a desire for change. There doesn't seem to be a desire for change here. This is the way the medical world functions. In many circumstances, they believe it appropriate. And the focus, again, is the fact that this person doesn't perceive that he has a quality of life. Now, this catchphrase, quality of life, is a loaded phrase. It means different things to different people. For the next few minutes, I'll just share with you some of the classic halakhic sources that in some way, shape, or form address the issue of quality of life. Keep in mind, many of these are from the Gemara, from Midrashim. They're not dispositive in the classical sense. They're not from the Shulchan Aruch. They're not the Sunyas of the Gemara. They are guiding in terms of a general hashkafic approach, but not definitive in terms of how we pass. But part of the reason I mention them is, first of all, these are classic things which are invariably discussed in these issues. And also, many of the postkeys are going to draw on these exact sources, so you should have a familiarity of these sources. When you're reading through the Tshuva literature on this topic, Tshuva literature is vast on anti-blight issues. So this is one of the classic stories, Clean and Tragion, from the Authority of Genophilus, which we read a number of times during the year. And we read about Rabbi Ben Tragion, Chazor Son, Masuhu, Rabbi Ben Tragion, Shai Yoshev, Ose Katora, Hedi Yuva, Karfu, Sacred Torah. And it's a horrific scenario. They wrapped him in the Sacred Torah, they Hedi Yuva, Chabilei Murach, they wrapped the bundles of cotton around him, they Tisu Bohanet Zahor, and they set them alight. Hedi Yuva, Fugim Shel Semer, these are the cotton soaked sponges. The sharum b'mayim, and they soaked them in water. Now, what was the objective of soaking them in water? The objective there was to delay his death and prolong the agony of his death, and as a form of torture. The sharum b'mayim, yichum al libo, they put him on his high kedesh lo say finish maso meheros, that his he wouldn't expire, his nishama would go l'shamayim quickly. Amalovito, his daughter, who sadly has observed this whole scenario, turns to her father and says, Abba, Erechbekach, how can I tolerate watching such a thing? So Amalovito, he's dropped people, Adi, etc., etc. So then his Talmidim turned to him. And they say, Amalovito, Talmido, Rebbe, Mat, Haroa, Amalovito, and Gilion, Yisrofim, Ozio, Porfos, I see the clock is burning, but the letters are Olo Shamayim are flying up to the sky. And the Talmidim hasten to add, Abba Tavsach Ticha V'tikaneh B'chah Eish. They plead with their Rebbe, say, open your mouth and let the flames consume you. You'll die sooner. If you open your mouth and let the flames enter into your mouth, your death will be accomplished much sooner. You will not have to suffer as a result. So Amar Lahem, this is the classic phrase excerpted from this sugya, Amar Lahem, Mutav Shi'it Lenem Yishenosno Ba'al Yachvol Hu'ba'atmo. It is preferable that the one who bestowed life, the Kadosh Baruch Hu granted life, be the one to take it back, and I should not be the one to hasten my own death. So there's a lot of analysis about the sugya, and careful microscopic analysis you can darshan in a number of different ways. But the classic interpretation of this is that, and we'll see the Ramah in a few minutes, which has the same kind of analysis, that active ways to hasten your own death are utter. But, and I apologize, I don't have the postscript here. The postscript of this Gemara is that the centurion, the Roman centurion, approached him with Hanina ben Tragion, and he said to him, if I remove these soaked sponges, these water-soaked sponges, will you promise me Olam Haba? So Hanina ben Tragion turned to the centurion and said, yes, if you remove the sponges, I promise you Olam Haba. So in fact, that is what exactly occurred. The Roman centurion removed the sponges, and Hanina expired very shortly thereafter, and the Gemara records as an addendum that both Hanina ben Tragion and the Roman centurion were removed to Olam Haba after this particular incident. So this helps us refine the chiluk here. Why is it that Hanina ben Tragion wouldn't open his mouth when his students asked him to open his mouth, yet he would allow the Roman centurion to remove these water-soaked sponges. So does anybody here have an idea what the nafkamina there might be?
Doing it yourself versus somebody else doing it to you.
Okay, excellent. And indeed, some people say that since the centurion was a goy has no chiyuv to... no iser in hastening the death of the individual, so maybe it was mutter for somebody else to do as opposed to him to do, yes?
It's
Brahma. So Brahma versus an active hastening of death. Or the phrase which has also been oft quoted, which we'll see again in the words of the Ramah, is removing an impediment to death versus actively hastening the death. So these soaked sponges were an impediment to Kadim and Tantra. Did you want to...
The
post results of
the centurion jumps into the fire
afterwards. Right, right, right. That's a peripheral kind of issue. You're absolutely correct. So he jumps into the fire. So why he received Olam Haba for actively killing himself? Technically, he was Ma'avid Asladat. He shouldn't be receiving Olam Haba. But focusing on the Hanina ben Tragion, the classic Nafkamina seems to be the removal of the impediment, which is the soaked sponges, versus the active hastening. So had Anita been tracking, didn't have his mouth open at that stage. His opening the mouth performs an act, an active event, which hastens his death in ways which would not have occurred had he not done that act. Whereas the sponges were already there, they were removing an impediment to death. That naphthamina is actually a huge naphthamina with practical applications in the classic scenario of the hospital intensive care unit about which medicine you can remove, withhold, withdraw, and we'll see that how that plays out in the different covers. Another one which is off-quoted is quoted by Ramosha, and I'll get to your question in 1 second, and it's also quoted by Rav Schefter in this tape that I listened to from January of this year. We'll talk in a second. Yes, to your question.
I was going
to
say, is opening your mouth considered an act of form of suicide?
Yes, in this case it would be. Because he is doing an act which will facilitate the flames entering his mouth and causing him to die. Whereas
if
he gets
in the same
closed.
Way, with his mouth being closed, that's removal of impediments to his death. He's not thinking about shooting himself.
With his mouth closed, he's going to Rahman Luslan pass away in 5 minutes. If he opens his mouth, he's performing an action which wouldn't otherwise have been there, and he'll expire in 1 minute. So he is performing a physical action, a mitzvah dying, or mitzvah peg, as in this particular case, where he would actually be causing his death to occur or transpire sooner than it otherwise would have. And these are very important duties, and these are in some cases difficult to sort out. And in fact, the American legal approach is that if the ultimate goal or the ultimate act of his expiration or his death is achieved, there's no naphthamina between whether you're actively doing it or withholding treatment. So the Ninth Circuit Court and the Second Circuit Court in the United States may have no naphthamina whatsoever between the groma, mitzvah, dying, zero. If as a result of your actions or inactions, this person will die at point A in time, they say there's no legal distinction whatsoever. Now, we hold there is a distinction between groma and mitzvah, dying. Yes?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure of this, so can I just present two things?
Absolutely.
First of all, what happens? He has the opportunity to remove the scrotum himself. Right?
Okay, good question.
And the implication would be, and based on this pillow, that there's an active or passive, he would be permitted to keep the scrotum off himself, but he's also forbidden from opening his mouth.
I would concur with that. Indeed, he himself removing the scrotum, that may have just been a practical matter, but because his hands were tied, he was simply incapable of removing the scrotum. But had he himself been capable of removing them, anathema, that would have been a removal of an impediment.
And what happens if his mouth is open but there's a scrotum in his mouth? So
they
have to take it out.
Okay, so you're getting more detailed.
You're right.
And this requires further analysis. Exactly in which case would it be a mitzvah, not to be a dying, not to be a dying? And we could analyze this, and indeed we might disagree on exactly which case would be a mitzvah dying, which case would be a groma. But let's go on and we'll see, because it's going to be manifest in a lot of different issues we discuss. So this is the famous case, also mentioned by Moshe Feinstein, and Schefter, and many others in discussing these issues. And what makes it more compelling, also, or as compelling, is it's talking about the Gedolim from previous generations. Here we have none other than Hanina ben Tradja, who underwent this circumstance, it wasn't just a Stam person. And here we have the Mechaber of the Mishnah himself, the Yehuda HaNasi, who's suffering from a debilitating medical illness, and how the end of his life was dealt with. And we use this for discussion also in terms of how to treat the patients at the end of life. So we can answer the Rebbe Lehigro. Rebbe, the scenario is that Yehuda HaNasi was severely ill. And his Rebbe, the Amsa, the Rebbe, is a famous woman whose presence in the house of Rebbe was known. She was obviously a very bright woman, and eavesdropping on the conversations of one of the great Gedolim in our history, she herself had knowledge of the Tarshu Baal Peh. And in circumstances of the Gemara, people would even listen to her thoughts from things that she had heard in the house of Rebbe, where she resided all these years. She saw her master, whom she was obviously very close with, in this extraordinary suffering, yet she didn't want her Rebbe to leave this earth. So she goes up to the roof, Salika Amson, the Rebbe, Eliezer Amra, El Yonim, the Vashimus Rebbe, the heavens are requesting in the presence of Rebbe Vashimus, the Vashimus Rebbe. And we down here on earth, we want to hold on to Rebbe as long as we can. He wrote some Shiakufu, Taftoni, Metal Yonim. Let us, let our prayers supersede your prayers. In other words, let's keep Rebbe here for a little longer. We don't want to let him go. However, Kevin, the Fuzzy, Kaman, Dinne, the Isle of Beis Hakise, the Cholat, Tfilin, Umanacha was becoming dire. However, when she started to witness the suffering, the actual human suffering, which was part of his condition, he obviously had some severe gastrointestinal illness, and it's telling also that the pain and suffering was the obviously more tone during the course of the day. So in order to go to the bathroom, he literally had to take off his tefillin and put on his tefillin every time. And this condition, the physicians have postulated exactly what medical conditions would have been, but whatever the case is, you require him to visit the bathroom multiple times in a severe and debilitating gastrointestinal condition. She saw the exquisite suffering every time he put on his tefillin and took off his tefillin, and she changed her mind. So what did she do now? Amra, she said, the exact opposite of what she had said before. Yirasim she'akufu el yonim es ha'tachtonim. Let the heavens take Rebbe. He doesn't need to suffer this much. Of course, we would love to have him on this earth, but it's not worth it for him to suffer in this kind of scenario. It's preferable that he die rather than continue his life in this suffering. But what was the problem? Why couldn't his feelings be miscavel? Well, ha'vishavku rabbonim yilavoy rachme. The problem was that all the thousands of students of Rebbe were begging, were being mispalel to keep Rebbe alive, and apparently those tefillos were helping. So she had to do something radical. What did she do? Shakla Kuza Shavya Meigra. She took a huge boulder, went up to the roof and tossed it off the roof, made a thunderous clap. Ishiku Merachme, in that millisecond that the rock hit the ground, the Rabbanim, the Talmidim, were distracted from prayer, but not naturally Rebbe. And Rebbe died in that instant. So there's a lot of things we can learn from this Gemara as well. I mean, thing number one is that a life in suffering, and by the way, even though this was the Rebbe, the Amsa Debe Rebbe who was doing this, the Gemara does not have a postscript here which says, Lo Kal Locha Nod Amsa Debe Rebbe. Or that we condemn the act of Amsa Debe Rebbe. Don't think when you're reading the Gemara that we think it's okay what the Amsa Debe Rebbe said. There's no such postscript. The Gemara leaves this unedited. In fact, the Ran and the Dorin uses this Gemara to talk about the power of tefillah and even suggest something extremely radical. And here, the context of the Gemara is talking about Bikur Cholim. And what you accomplish when you're Mevaker Cholim, one of the things you accomplish is your ability to be mispalel for that individual. So being mispalel for an individual, you can do if you're not in the hospital. But if you see the individual and you see their particular condition, you see their particular needs, then you'll be able to be mispalel in a very directed fashion for this individual. The Ran says something very radical. Near the Ein Ayin Hafikam. How many Mishpachavaki Shrachim Malachavala Shiyos? There are even times where you have to request your tefillos will be that this individual die. No one ever assumed that. We all assume that. Who's going to be mispalel for somebody to die? If you think somebody should die, so you just refrain from being mispalel. You don't actively mispalel that that person should die. He says, he's going to be starapolokolio, like a person is in excruciating suffering, the EF Charlotte, you get. And there's no, he has no prognosis. He's not going to, he or she is not going to survive from this medical condition. In the reading of Parakadosa, this is the Gemara which we just talked about in Sudas Kodalit, the Kaven, the Chazay Amsa, the Rebbe, etc., etc. Mishum Hachi Ka'amar, and that's why it says, to have a Vakar Chola, that someone who visits somebody is sick, Mo'ilo B'Tfilaso, you will assist that Chola in your davening, this is quite a Kiddush, Afil Lichyos B'Tnevi Tfilah Yos Uwele, Umisha Eilu B'Vakro, and someone who refrains from visiting, obviously, you're not going to be effective in helping him to live because you're not there to accomplish his tefillos. Ela afilu hechi deikilei hanoa b'misa afilu osan zutrusei in amaneu, which is a tremendous pitch. You're not even giving him the benefit of being followed for his death. So if you have someone who is in excruciating, extraordinary, unremitting pain, you will benefit him by visiting him in the hospital and being followed for his death. And if you don't go to the hospital, you are depriving him of the benefit of praying for his death, and allowing his death to be accomplished, and not allowing his death to be accomplished sooner. A tremendous, tremendous pitch. So the big question is, actually we'll get to this round, we'll delay this round, the interpretation of this round for a minute. Let us address some of the other stories that you find in the Chazal about the quality of life. The Yalpi Shimoni has this also remarkable story. A massive Hisha Akashi Kina Harbe regarding a woman who became very old. In this day and age, you know, people Baruch Hashem were living till 100 plus years. Both of these Rebbe Yossi ben Halasta, and she came in front of Yossi and Halasta. I'm the Rebbe. He's Kanti Yossi Midai Meyashka Kain Shel Nibulhein. She ain't Toenet, Lo Nafo, Lo Mashke, then Vakesha Flipa Kermia Olam. She approaches Yossi and Halasta and said, listen, my life is not worth living anymore. I can't taste the food that I eat, and I'm enjoying my daily existence. The Baruch Hashem had a long life. I don't want to go on anymore. What should I do? Avali ma mitzvah ak lemudu la'asos b'chol yom. It says to inquire, what mitzvah are you extremely particular about that you do every single day of your life? So Amrlo says, lemudu ani afil yeshu davar chaviv ani munat manechet oso mashkenos b'beis ha'knesos b'chol yom. Said, my entire life I've been extraordinarily particular, never miss a day of davening. I go to shul every single day, never miss a day in my life. So Amar La, he said to her, Miti Asmechi Beis HaKnesset, Shloshu Yomim Zeachar Zeh, stop going to shul for 3 days. Halko the Osso came, and in fact, after she did, she refrained from going to shul, but honestly, she also made some, and the third day she does. So here also you have at least the introduction of the notion. And again, these are midrashim, these are not halachic sources, that life is not worth living at all costs. That at least our Masorah acknowledges the notion that there is suffering which is not worth living, and it is at least a possibility that someone could want their lives to end sooner because of this unremitting suffering. And here, the other context, now this is a halachic source, this is not a midrashim. Here we get into this notion of a particular patient in a particular situation who is labeled by the Gemara and by the Poskim as a Goseis. Has anyone come across the term Goseis before? What is your general understanding of what a Goseis is?
Somebody who can establish for certainty that it helps him
to die. So close, very close. There is an ether to touch a Goseis, to move a Goseis. But the general assumption is, and this has a history also, Goseis, and the definition of Goseis is a later development in the halakhic literature. It's not, doesn't date back exactly from time of the Gemara. This definition is, I think, believes it originates with the Maharami Rutenberg, that the assumption is that this individual will die within 3 days' time. The Goseis is somebody who will die within 3 days' time. And in this context, the Shulchan Aruch says, despite the fact that this person will indeed die or has a very high likelihood, close to certainty, that he'll die in 3 days, Shulchan Aruch says, a ghost is a ray of Kachai the whole Torah. Don't think, just because he's on the verge of death, that he's any less alive at this time for these 3 days. So he can give a get to his wife, he can execute a will, he can execute any business transaction. He has a full status of Kachai as long as he's technically alive. So don't think that just because he's on the verge of death that he's considered dead in the eyes of Allah. So go through the Chayla Ozor. But, therefore, by the way, in Kosher Mechayav, in Sakinoza, so don't think you can start making funeral preparations. He may be comatose. He may be not even able to speak. He may know he's going to die. But don't say, you know, let's save time. Let's start, these are procedures which were done for during the course of the funeral. They would tie his mandible and the maxilla together, they would perform some salve on the skin, a madichino, so these are things that the Chemer Kadisha would normally do. You're not allowed to start this process even though you know he's going to die within a short period of time. Being poking this mechalav, these are also the orifices of the body, you don't close up. And shomti nakarmi tato, you can't remove a pillow from him. A nosnino fogabi apol. You're not allowed to move a ghost. Even to this very day, there's an issue of Zizas HaGoseis, being made through the Goseis. And this has practical halakhic ramifications. So, for example, Shlomo Zalman Orbach was asked to Shaila if you had somebody who has a good chance of survival, And in your path between the treatment that is required for this individual is a go safe. Are you allowed to move the go safe in order to accomplish the treatment of somebody who's not a go safe? Because in the possible movement of the go safe, you might indeed hasten the death of that individual. There's an answer being made to the go safe. And I will tell you from personal experience that in the emergency department, I've seen many times people on the verge of death who are relatively stable. And they transfer them from one stretcher to another stretcher, or they want to transfer them possibly to perform some kind of procedure, a test, they have a cardiac arrest. Now, this is obviously anecdotal. I haven't performed any official, you know, medical study on this. But there's no question that the movement of somebody who is on the verge of death can indeed cause problems and can potentially hasten death. The cholam ame to be fierce on nefesh, this is quoted from the Rambam. So ein ma'am sin ein avach tekenash. He can't even close his eyes. He can't even bring the eyelids down to close the eyes. And the Rambam said, the cholam ame to be fierce on nefesh, or in the shofet government. Anybody who closes the eyes in the fierce on nefesh, as opposed to after you fierce on nefesh, is considered a shofet government. Even something such as some minor that yet.
I don't need to split here, but just all the situations where it breaks down, you can't do the good, it needs to be done. Directly to the individual's body, or if that individual's body points to local.
Correct.
That also applies to things with rolling the bed that they're on, so they have a movable bed. And we speak
here. These are excellent questions. So is grumma being made to use the ghost? If you physically move the body on the bed, or even moving the stretcher might be considered being made to use the ghost. So if you accomplish movement of the body, even by grumma, it's still a violation of being made. And we'll see, by the way, that the Ramah talks about, we'll see in the presently, that the Ramah actually talks about things which aren't even connected to those things. And how we deal with certain things like that. Yes, did you have a question?
I'm sorry, I actually had to down discussing the case.
Yes, and he said he was actually hesitant. He wasn't clear that you could move the ghost. He was very nervous about moving the ghost. I think the antipathy you could be Matzil Nefesh. But one of the things you're not allowed to do is one of the things you're not allowed to do is cross nefesh is reticha. So if there's a concern that you might actually cause the death of another individual to save that one individual, it's that you can't do. So how do you have, you know, so I think that there are ways to get around it. If you can maybe move, I think he might even have some suggestions like you said about maybe moving indirectly, or there's no issur of being made to go say for a goy to get a goy to move the body. Those are all issurs which could accomplish the same. This is the key. This is the famous Ramah. And clearly, and this is very important, while it's true, if this person is a ghost safe, you are not allowed to hasten their death in any way, shape, or form. So someone who is lingering and is not it's a strange phrase, means he's not being allowed to die. Also, he shomeis hakar v'keset tafta. You can't remove the pillow from him. V'chein osur l'asum matelos beis hakneset tachas rosha. This is some form of segula. If you put the keys of the shul under his pillow, that might be a way of bringing him into the next world. Kedei shiyupare. Aval, and this is a very important phrase, about im yesh sham davar, shegorein ikub yisiyat neshama. If there is something that is currently going on, which is causing his yitzias neshama, kigon sheyesh somachos habayis. Actually, shegorein iku yitzias neshama. That's preventing his death. There's something going on that's causing his death to be delayed. Kigon sheyesh somachos habayis kol dovek. And this we're talking about things which are happening not connected to the body, but separate from the body. Like someone is chopping wood in the yard next door, and that continued stimulation, auditory stimulation, is perpetuating the life of that individual. If you're going to cultivate, or he has salt on his tongue, and that salt is causing stimulation to the tongue, which is perpetuating or delaying the onset of death. They're delaying the ascension of the nefesh. Mutter lahasiro misham. You are permitted to remove them. Why? To aim of the master cloud. Because in these circumstances, this is very important to you, there is no master be a dying which is causing the death of the individual. Ella shemesir hamonea. You are removing the impediment to death. And this is the chilos that the the Drumline Institute, which all the building posts can address. And what I want to point out is that there is a big debate about the clinical applicability of this ghost safe scenario to the intensive care unit in the hospital today. So take on the one side, Rabbi Blight, first of all, issue number one is simply identifying which one of your patients is a ghost safe. So I'm a physician in the hospital and I'm standing at a bedside. Do I know with certainty that my patient's going to die within 3 days? Is a ghost safe, and I'll get to your question in a second, is a ghost safe someone who's going to die in 3 days with treatment, with all that modern medicine in the 21st century has to offer, or is a ghost safe someone's going to die in 3 days in the absence of treatment? And assuming it's even with treatment, when the Ramah mentions all these things, the Ramah doesn't say you can withhold, keeping it in the historical context in the 1500s, you can withhold all the herbs or the medicines that were thought to preserve this patient's life. The things that he mentions, the common denominators, they're all skulos. Putting the key under the pillow, or these kinds of things, or the melach was not probably a medical treatment. The wood chopping was clearly not a medical treatment. So maybe the only things which are non-medicinal treatments you can withhold, but it doesn't give you a right to withhold medical treatment. But life actually kind of that even if you can define somebody as a ghost face, the Ramah does not give you a license to withhold any medical treatment. The Ramah is only talking about skulos and nothing else. Yes.
Ramon seems to say that you can have a ghost is bone entry. It says ghost is man.
Yes, excellent point. What does that mean, ghost is man or? Right, so the three-day definition is a debated definition. And indeed, there's some posting to say that if a person is in an irrevocable spiral towards death, and the process of death has begun, then indeed they could be considered a ghost face, even if it's longer than 3 days. And I think Rav Schefter holds that also. I don't think he's bound to the three-day definition. Yes.
I was thinking that you have a condition where if they're all dying, every day it's kind of bigger than it's taking longer and longer, but every day it's constant additional.
That's definitely a valid interpretation. Absolutely. I just wanted to share this with you because this the wood chopping is such an interesting case. I found this in a journal called the Cortland Forum, which is a medical journal in which people recount interesting cases that they had. So I'll just read through this quickly. I was making rounds at the hospital late one evening, and I received a call that one of my dearest patients had been brought into the emergency room with heart failure. The ER physician said she would need cardiac resuscitation very soon. I replied she had a living will, she wanted nothing done. In the ER, I found Cora, who had pulmonary edema, sitting up in bed. She was semi-conscious, but she roused. Gave me her mischievous smile and whispered that she loved me. And I ushered the ER personnel out of the room, and I said, let's let her pass in peace. Miss Cora's cardiac rhythm went from ventricular tachycardia to ventricular fibrillation and gradually to asystole, which is flatline. As I felt the pulse disappear, I quickly told Martha that her sister was dying. Martha cried out and squeezed her older sister's arm, telling her repeatedly that she loved her. Suddenly, she awoke from what seemed like a nap and told her sister that she loved her as well. And this woman was flatlined. Basically, in a minute or two, she would have been declared dead. The scenario was repeated 3 more times that night. Each episode of asystole lasted for 30 seconds to a minute, each time she revived. I suggested to the family that we place her in a private room and allow her the comfort of dying, telling the family members to be quiet as possible because Mrs. Cora would probably pass on within the next few minutes. I left the room. A few minutes later, family members told me she had expired. I went to her bedside and could feel no pulse. Then the phone in the room rang, and Mrs. Carr once again returned to this earth. The next morning, I found her eating breakfast, awake and cheerful. And she actually died 2 weeks later. So I thought, I was reading this, and I was thinking of the Ramah, the wood chopping. This is a woman who was basically dead. This phone call and the screaming of her sister was for all these types of things. This is sort of a modern-day, Ikuvitsiyos HaNefesh, the wood chopping being replaced by the phone call. So now to return to the clinical application of the Ramah. So, and this is the Shita of Moshe. Moshe, in applying the Ramah to today's scenario, today's circumstances, Moshe says, the question she came to our Ramah, the that the reason behind the sakka dharma, that is permitted to remove things that are delaying death and allow death to transpire sooner, the svara behind Rama, the Rama doesn't say this himself, it's the emotion, assumption about the svara dharma, that the person is suffering. And there's no mitzvah lehefa. Now there's no mitzvah to preserve suffering, it's a mitzvah not to require suffering, not to perpetuate life and suffering. That's how Moshe understood. Is that notion of the unremitting pain and suffering, which is the basis of Moshe's fundamental shita about the treatment of patients at the end of life. In stark contrast to this, and I'm not going to read it inside, but in stark contrast to this, specifically at the end.
Can you just explain what that means?
I'll explain, actually, I'll flesh it out in just a moment. We'll do a few more excerpts from Moshe, because it's extremely important to understand what underlies his approach to the treatment of patients at the end of life. The Tzitzeliezer opposes Moshe. The Tzitzeliezer says that pain and suffering are advantageous and are a kapara and should be welcomed and encouraged. And it will allow somebody a greater time in Olam Haba by suffering in Olam Haza. So he does not share the sentiment of Ramosha that pain and suffering is the sorrow behind Ramah, nor does he allow you to withhold any treatment, even if a patient has unremitting suffering. Yes?
What's the support for that?
So he says, for example, here's one of the classic sources. One of the classic sources is from Sosa. You see it's on the third line in Sosa. In Sosa, what happens when a woman drinks the Mayim HaMa'arim? Her body explodes and she dies in short order. So Gemara says, if she has the chuyos outside this particular circumstance of her adultery, then she is blessed with preservation of her life for a longer period of time in excruciating suffering to delay her death. The shaila is that the toga for her? What does she need to have her death prolonged? So the answer is that there may be a value even in the light of suffering. There is value. This is one of the chorus that the Sicilian mentioned. Yes.
So what does he do with the Ramah?
So he doesn't say that the Ramah is based on suffering. He says that if a person is it's just medical, and perhaps that the fact is the time frame. That the person has begun the process of death, we don't have a right to interfere in the process of death, but not related to the fact of suffering. Because the reason why it's so important that Moshe focuses on suffering is because Moshe takes it out of the context of the gozei and allows you to withhold treatment from patients who are suffering, even if they're not expected to die within 3 days. That's where the pain and suffering of Moshe's analysis is so essential in his general approach. Yes. Good question. So we spend, how do you balance that? There is a notion, there's an existential notion of the toelus of suffering, of Yisurin, and you probably need this in your philosophy courses about the concept of Yisurin, both individual Yisurin, collective Yisurin. How does that jive with taking Tylenol and taking aspirin? The Tzitzel Yezer never take a Tylenol in his life. The truth is that's why many people don't agree with the Tzitzeliezer. They do say that the mitzvah, and even for me, this has halachic relevance and application. There are many patients that I can't cure, and my sole role in their treatment is just to provide them pain management. And of the patients that come into the ER, probably 60% of them are in pain for some cause, or even all causes, whatever they may be, is pain. So I treat pain, and I'm mekayem a mitzvah of refuah, of arapo yirape, by giving somebody Tylenol. When I'm not treating their medical condition, I'm just treating their pain. So the answer is, it's not so clear, but Rabbi Bleif, for example, has a lengthy article on the palliation of pain, where he has a mahalas that says clearly that the treatment of pain is an integral part of the mitzvah of refuah. That pain itself is an illness, and treating the pain itself is a mitzvah. There is clearly no mitzvah for any of us to be in continued pain for any of the medical conditions that we may endure. We should never endure them. And it's obviously mutter to take Tylenol, Motrin, Enzo, whichever one of your pain medicines you like to take. So it's very difficult to to jive the philosophical notion of the value of yusuri with the day-to-day aspect of medical care. And the same thing is true, by the way, with ikud yitzias ha-nefesh. When do we know when yitzias ha-nefesh? You know, I'm standing at the bedside. I mean, I might delude myself into believing that I can tell a patient's going to die within a few minutes. I have the experience of medicine to know that someone's going to expire within a few minutes. That means when do you see us in nefesh take place? What is the exact moment that you see us in nefesh? If I could know when you see us in nefesh would take place, that would be very very helpful, not only practically, but helpful halakhically. So that's also sort of a metaphysical notion which doesn't really impact on the practical, real halakhic world. So, for example, you're going to talk about brain death. If some folks in the hold brain death as a halachic death, does that mean that they hold yitzias ha-nefesh takes place for the brain dead patient, and if some hold yitzias ha-nefesh doesn't take place for the brain dead patient? So how are you gonna prove that? Yes, two questions. Yes.
And the truth or the real thing depends on whether they're lacking functionality. Like if a person can do more than one thing, then it's better to take them out of pain. Like the equivalent is better to be using pain. More of the team is better to have the other relation or.
Right, so there are individuals, there are clearly ascetics, and there are subgroups in the Jewish history who have prayed for Yisurin, who have relished Yisurin, but that's not normative, that's not the normative approach. But your point, well taken, we will address that, is the perception of Yisurin. And where that becomes directly relevant is when the patient is comatose. And from our perspective, it is unclear to us whether that individual has a sensation of pain or not. And if pain is the determinant for withholding care, there's a huge amount. We can actually pause this in a whole question for another week. Rabbi Schwartz, when is our...
2:40.
2:40, okay, good. So here's the real practical halakhic question. Is it ever permitted to withhold care? Do you have to give care all the time under all circumstances? If yes, if you can withhold care, what is the halakhic framework for withholding care? How is the gosei, as we alluded to some of these already, how is the gosei defined as manazeh, and does this definition have practical halakhic application? We won't get into this question, that is the halakhic definition of trefa. Trefa is in animals, is generally considered an animal who's not going to live more than yud-beis chodesh. There are halachic nafkaminas for a human trefa also, although the definitions of trefa, so for example, you're not chayav misa, haraga for trefa is not chayav misa. And there are halachic nafkaminas, we won't get into the trefa today. There's another dimension. You know, we talk about suffering, not suffering, withholding, not withholding. Are the wishes of the patient taken into consideration? What is the relevance of the wishes of the patient? So you might argue, according to the Sicilian there, you know, if a person is suffering and he says, I don't want to be the life continued in suffering, it's arguable that the patient's wishes are irrelevant. Because if suffering is objectively positive, the patient's wishes are not relevant. Yes?
Is that the distinctions of patients that you are not Jew?
Well, our framework is there are many distinctions in halacha, whether a patient is a Jew or a non-Jew, in terms of
specifically with withholding care and keeping the patient alive during.
Yes, our view had followed. Is within the framework of Torah observant Jews, or within the Jewish community, all our chiyuvim, we have a chiyuv or refuah for non-Jews to a certain extent also, that they themselves, if they want to withhold care, I do not have a chiyuv to force them to accept care because of my halachic framework, if they themselves refuse care. So non-Jews, for example, don't have a chiyuv hatzolah on themselves as we do. So if a non-Jew comes into the hospital and says, I want a do not resuscitate order, or I don't want to be dialyzed, or I don't want antibiotics, or I don't want blood transfusion, I don't have any fears to try and coerce them to accept those treatments. And there are many other areas where there would be other knocking. Are the wishes of the patient taken into consideration? If the patient is unable to decide for himself, can a family member decide on behalf of the patient without decision-making capacity? And these are many of the decisions we made for people who are comatose. Moshe says, and I didn't bring the exact quotation for this, but Moshe says that the assumption is that yes, indeed, the family member can decide on behalf of the patient. It's unclear to me whether there's a clear halachic precedent for that, whether there's a clear marker for that, or it's just practically that if the patient's family has arthritis for their medical care, and they can make the decision. Also, motion rests on the assumption they will act in the best interest of the patient. However, Schefter is not so accepting of this, and he based it, I don't remember the exact analysis, but he based it on Lana's oil, that that the family doesn't always have the right to decide on behalf of the patient. And he also quotes literature, which there is literature of this kind, that the family isn't always capable of making the correct decision on behalf of the patient. That when they had patients who were on the verge of death and families made a decision, and the patient was thought that it was thought they were going to die, but they actually survived, and they interviewed these patients afterwards and they said, did your family member make the correct decision? Is that what you would have wanted in that case? And many of the patients said, no, the family got it completely wrong. So that's you know, that is there's a subsegment of literature like that. But the mice that we rely very heavily in the practical world on the patient's families to assist us in decision making. That's the value, by the way, of the living will, is that the living will allows the family to make decisions which the patient would be comfortable with, as opposed to imagining what the patient would have wanted without knowing directly. So this is the another elaboration of the position of emotion on the treatment of patients at the end of life. Here the heading is Yesh Cholim She'en Liteim and Trufos Baruch HaKayim. And he quotes the Gemara of Amsa the Rebbe. Says the Nakaz Dad Gemara Lash Minim the Ikal Yifamim Shesar Seis Palel Al Ha'Olim Kishu Mitzar Ein Moi Limin Yer Kulos Rapos Rapaso But Tzil She Travel Lo Yiskal Shesar Seis Palel Shiyam. Quoting the, you know, this is what the Ran had said also. And he writes here, the inche, this is the key line, the inche kahai gazma, sha'arofi makirim shi'iyashalo l'shapos l'ishios, that the physicians identify that this patient cannot be treated from their underlying condition. So a person has a severe pneumonia, that antibiotics are not working. A person has a cancer, which all known treatments have been exhausted, the chemotherapy doesn't work, radiation therapy doesn't work. There's no question that this patient is not going to survive from this particular medical condition. The af loshi is yet emotional cola below yasurim, and furthermore, there is no way for them to relieve adequately the suffering that this individual has. About actually painless sami refuela haris yomov, but they can give him medicine that will prolong his life a little bit, kemoshu, in this continuing suffering. Ein litain lo mina refuel ele yanichum kemoshu. Leave him alone, allow nature to take its course, do not give him medicines to perpetuate his life. But, because part of it also is his concern that the medicines themselves might hasten the death, but also the perpetuating the life of suffering is simply not the value that neither the patient nor the Torah would consider to be an ideal value. Do you have any questions? Yes.
First, I mean, obviously, what kind of suffering you have to decide each case, or how do you determine?
So the patient determines what suffering is. And also, I mean, it's difficult with the patient or whether there's a medical assumption that suffering is going on. So the patient is unconscious, and then we'll get to it in a minute. There's huge anatomy in the approach to this for people who are in the comatose state. Then what is the halakhic status of these people? Do we consider them suffering and withhold take the treatment, or do we not? And here's the key line, and it says, the Ella, she shaved al kasa. It's better to do nothing, to allow nature to take its course. But if there are medicines that will provide comfort, but they won't shorten his lifespan. Even though he's not a ghost. So the key here is that Ramosha is expanding his framework of withholding care from the patient to patients who are not even in the status of gesita. Those are the status of gesita of one category. Those are expected that are literally on death's door, could die in 3 days. There are patients who could live months, maybe even years with these horrific diagnoses. So Moshe is applying this notion of unremitting suffering in order to allow us to withhold care. Yes?
Is the doctor making the decision, or even the patient is not allowed to take such medicine?
So then the shaila is that the patient himself says, I know I'm suffering. I think suffering is a toilet for me. I want to take the medicines, and I want to continue the suffering. So there, I think even emotion would allow the patient to do that. The question is for the patient says, I don't want to continue the suffering. or if you don't know, you're unable to. Now, some have argued, including Roy Blight, that this scenario of Moshe, Bizmana Zed, when we have such effective pain medicines, and palliation is now its own specialty, palliation pain, and treatment of the end of life is its own subspecialty, where aggressive pain management can alleviate pain, he argues, as do others, that there is simply no patient whose pain can't be treated. That everybody can get pain relief, and that undermines this whole mahalak of Moshe. Emotions, mahalak is predicated on unremitting suffering. But if you time it and medicine can alleviate that suffering, so maybe the person, we can't withhold treatment from these patients. So that's a tough point to argue. The problem is that some of these medicines will render the person unconscious. So I don't know if that's a tohelus of that individual either. Yes, sir.
Unless we define Yisurim like the Yalkut Shimoni. I'm very old, I don't have enjoyment in life.
Right, there could be different than physical, actual pain yisurim, could be metaphysical or existential yisurim. The problem is, then you enter into the slippery slope of somebody who has no medical illness, but has a psychiatric or a psychological condition, who says, I have no reason to live my life. That I don't think your emotion would allow you to do anything. Yeah. Correct. Correct. Now we'll talk about when we get to our last section is on morphine, which could potentially hasten death. And that's a shot. But most medicines are not the life-ending ones.
What's the largest significance?
No, the significance of that is you don't want to give a medicine. So you might argue that this person's in pain. Let's give him a medicine that will shorten his life. The pain medicine that will shorten his life. So Moshe is very clear in other tshuvas that you absolutely categorically do nothing to make this person's life end sooner. You can't prolong, you have no keys to prolong the life in pain, and indeed it might be a mitzvah not to prolong the life. It's the same chalukim about actively hastening versus allowing nature to take its course. But you can't give potassium chloride like Dr. Kevorkian did to say, well, I'm alleviating the pain of the patient by giving him potassium chloride because he's going to die. So that's that.
What is the difference between elongating someone's life and, you know, sure, if I can elongate someone's life for 2 years, so I'll never cure them, they can live another 2 years.
Right.
So
the difference is, the answer would be, if we cannot cure the condition which will ultimately lead to the demise of the individual. So the easiest way to understand that is cancer. A person has end-stage cancer, they're going to die from this cancer, it's just a matter of time. We can give them chemotherapy which will prolong their life 6 months, but chemotherapy is associated with nausea and vomiting and horrendous side effects. Or we cannot give them the chemotherapy and they'll have shown dying months. That's really the simplest way to understand. So you're not curing, you cannot cure the underlying condition which will definitely lead to the demise of the individual.
Well, let's say I can't cure, but I can elongate someone's life for 2 years.
Okay, so
that would be much to say versus, let's say, a month.
Right, they have to analyze, each case requires extensive analysis. So if the guy's going to live for 5 years or 10 years with this condition, so then the assumption is that the person has a terminal illness. And I thank you for helping me really clarify that. The assumption is, for Moshe, the person has a terminal illness. Not a lifelong illness which causes pain. If people have lifelong illnesses for which they will not die anytime soon, which unfortunately arthritis. There are many forms of arthritis which cause severe chronic pain. So Moshe wouldn't allow these patients to withhold treatment. Person has to have a terminal condition which will ultimately, within short order, lead to their demise. Now, then the question arises as to which medicines can be withheld or not withheld. Antibiotics, blood transfusions, medicines to maintain blood pressure, dialysis, and there's my book in the posting about all these kinds of things. Now, we are talking about a lot of different scenarios. I do apologize. There are many, many things we're not going to be able to discuss in depth. So even every one of these, there's machlokes posting about when to give antibiotics and not to give antibiotics. For example, let's say if someone is suffering from cancer up front of the lung, and the prognosis is that they're not expected to live for 6 months, but now they receive that prognosis today, but next week they get a pneumonia. You have to treat that pneumonia. Pneumonia has nothing to do with the cancer. You just got an infection. They could die as a result of the pneumonia if you don't treat it. But it's not the pneumonia that's their underlying condition which is going to cause them to die. So do you have a fever to treat the pneumonia? Do you not have a fever to treat the pneumonia? So you're supposed to post him in which scenario you do and which scenario you don't. So in terms of executing these decisions, there are now two documents that exist in the halakhic world. There's the RCA living will, and there's the Aguda healthcare proxy. Now, what is a living will, and what is a healthcare proxy? These are important definitions for you to understand. A living will is a document that an individual signs when they are of sound mind, which says, under these scenarios, I want such and such done. Under these scenarios, I don't want this done. I don't want to be resuscitated if my heart stops. Excuse me, I don't want to be intubated if I stop breathing. That's something that an individual signs. The original RCA will, which we are actually, the last year or two, been revisiting, more for medical reasons than for halakhic reasons, was a very detailed document which had, you know, five or six or maybe more scenarios that one could potentially encounter at the end of life. Yes?
What constitutes sound mind?
Sound mind is a medical assessment of the person's ability to understand the consequences of their decision, which is a spectrum. There are some people who are a little like mildly demented, early Alzheimer's, for example, where they're not in severe dementia, where they can still understand. So there is a spectrum of what it means to sound mind. It's not such a clear answer. So that's what a living will is, a document that allows an individual to help make their decisions even at the point where they're not able to. A healthcare proxy is very simply an individual who is appointed who will make the decisions for you. So the a good healthcare proxy says, you know, here's a rabbi who will make the decisions at the end of my life. Should I not be able to make the decisions? The assumption is that the rabbi will make the decisions see how long. Now, our next issue is coma or persistent vegetative state. Now, you may remember the story of Terry Schiavo. Terry Schiavo was a woman who sustained a cardiac arrest at a very young age, in her 20s. She was resuscitated. And she survived the resuscitation. Unfortunately, her brain lost oxygen for a period of time, and she lost consciousness, and she never regained consciousness. She lived for years in a state of a persistent vegetative state. So that you may be familiar with the term, and don't misinterpret this term. It has very, very ugly, bad connotations. A vegetable. Somebody who's a vegetable. The reason that the term vegetable evolved is that from this term persistent vegetative state, the vegetative or basic functions of the body are still functioning. So she could breathe on her own, she still had a blood pressure, a pulse, and she basically lived for many, many years. She simply was not conscious, unconscious. And here's the epitaph which her husband wrote. Teresa Marie Schiavo, born December 1963, departed from this earth February 25th, 1990. That's when she had her cardiac arrest and lapsed into a coma. At peace, March 31st, 2005, that's when she died. And the question is, you know, do we consider this to be an accurate assessment from a halakhic perspective? And the answer is categorically no. But there are the medical issues here. So the coma cell patient experienced pain. Very important, which I'm not going to discuss because Mr. Shum will discuss next week. Coma cell patient is not brain dead. Brain dead is a very restricted definition of a very specific type of case where the brain has sustained severe trauma and the person has no independent respiration. These patients who are in a persistent vegetative state are not hooked up to respirators. They're breathing spontaneously on their own. They have no terminal condition. Terry Schiavo had no terminal condition. There was no disease from which she was expected to die in the short term. None. She could have lived for decades. And the debate which ensued about her care, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, is whether the feeding tube should be removed or the feeding tube shouldn't be removed. Because once she stopped being fed, then she would surely die soon. So the husband wanted her to stop being fed, and the parents didn't want her to stop being fed. Now, what are the halakhic issues? Is a coma cell patient treated differently in the eyes of halakha? Is a comatose patient considered to be suffering from intractable pain such that treatments can be withheld? So Moshe's whole mahalat was that the patient's in intractable pain. Is a comatose patient in intractable pain? As far as we can understand, these patients may not be suffering pain. They're not sentient beings that feel or experience pain. Is the requirement for food or to treat infections different for the comatose patient? So Moshe Paskin, these two issues are different issues. First of all, needs to mention it because it's such an essential part of end-of-life care. Here, Moshe's talking about not patients who are at the end of life necessarily, but just differentiating in care for patients who are conscious or mentating or of sound mind, if you ask the question, or patients who are handicapped or debilitated or developmentally disabled, which the secular society does oftentimes differentiate. So here he says, the Vaday Pashat to borrow me a dual Kol Ben Torah Miresha Mind. So don't think for 1 minute that just because someone has a severe mental debility or handicap that they are any less status of a human being or a nefesh than anybody sitting in this room. So the chiyuv for refuah applies clearly to all of these patients who suffer any mental incapacity. But just return to the issue specifically of treating a comatose patient with a terminal condition. But Moshe says, Mashi Yomra Rokim Shehino Margish Pragmi Surim. And this may be what Rabbi Schwartz is alluding to. So the doctors will say that this patient doesn't experience pain. He's unconscious, not relating to his environment. Hey, Mahamino. He actually tried to see him do the Hamash Mashiku. He sees the Nefesh of the Surim. Absholomi Karlam. There may be dimensions of existential pain, of delaying the ikum nefesh, or the ikum rather, the ikum seals nefesh, which are causing existential pain to this individual. So Moshe Paskins, that just like you can withhold treatment from a patient in intractable pain, you can likewise withhold treatment from a patient who is comatose, because that comatose patient is likewise experiencing pain. So Rabbi Yashiv is Machalik, and he says like this, the ability to withhold treatment, even though Moshe held, the truth is Yashu didn't even hold it so much. Raki machola solely stirring caution. Mavakesh lo yarichu chayim v'tikulin chayel v'tikulin chayel v'tikulin chayel v'tikulin chayel v'tikulin. So only if someone has discernible pain can you withhold care. V'lochein, therefore, v'chola shenim to v'choster ha'kar v'chla, someone who is in complete coma, the afilu imugder k'mavas mochi, even if he's brain dead, kol shalom borosh yisodim yisurim, if it is not clear to the observer that this person is suffering from pain, ha'yavim ha'asosu ha'kol, kol ha'ayah k'dei l'harish v'chayim. You have to do everything, including CPR. So basically, the world of halacha is in essence divided into those who hold the mahalik of Moshe, that allow, in general, the concept that pain and suffering are not an intrinsic value, and that there are circumstances that have to be analyzed on a case-by-case basis where it is permitted to withhold care. And there are those who are in the camp generally of the Sicily Ezra and Bill Yashu that are much less willing to withhold treatment and are much more aggressive with treatment at the end of life, requiring all types of treatment in all forms, even those who are in a status of brain death. Just to give you an interesting medical scientific update to this notion of coma and how it might impact on how we tackle these issues in the future, there's interesting literature, and this is one of a few cases, and this was published in a journal called Science, which is a very reputable journal. What they did is they took a number of patients who were in a persistent vegetative state or in coma, and they subjected them to what's called a functional MRI. Functional MRI is an imaging study, which is not a static imaging study. It just doesn't take a picture at one time. It shows the function of the chemical function of certain areas in the brain. So what they did is they did a fascinating study. They took a number of normal adults, and they asked a few questions. They said, imagine yourself playing tennis. And they performed a functional MRI, and a certain part of the brain lit up. I said, imagine walking through the rooms in your house at home. And another part of the brain lit up. The correlating part of the brain which is involved in that type of thought process. Then they took a number of patients in a persistent vegetative state and subjected them to the exact same functional MRI. So patient after patient after patient, there was no light up at all in the brain. Then they got to one patient who had severe organic brain damage. And lo and behold, they asked this woman, she'd been in a coma for 5 years, imagine yourself playing tennis. Slowly, the part of the brain lit up exactly as her the corresponding healthy volunteer. It said, imagine yourself going through your room at home. Lo and behold, all these parts of the brain lit up. No one thought this woman had any capability of understanding her outside environment. None. Yet, this study determined that, in fact, she had the ability to understand and to think, just as those who are not in a coma. And this is from August of 2007. That same person is continuing to do more studies in functional MRI and found another individual. He only did another 10 patients at this time and got a response from another person who was in a persistent vegetative state. So the question is, would this literature impact on the machlokas between Rav Moshe and the Rav Eliyoshiv if these people were perceived so in essence, these people might be perceived to have pain because they're conscious and they're sentient. We would have to divide them into different subpopulations of people who were positive with the functional MRI and those who were not positive with the functional MRI. Just really food for thought. And a correlative study, which is a very interesting study also, is there was a patient who was comatose for many years, a couple patients across the world to whom this has occurred. And the doctors prescribed a certain medicine because he was having some twitching. So they gave him the medicine. The medicine they gave him was Ambien. Does anyone know what Ambien is? Have you heard Ambien? Sleeping pill. Excellent. This guy's been sleeping for years, and they gave him a sleeping pill. So they gave it for different reasons, because they thought it might help with the certain twitching he had. Lo and behold, within a half an hour after ingesting the Ambien, the patient woke up and started to speak. His mother almost had a heart attack. But he woke up, and it didn't last. It lasted for like a few minutes. The patient actually awoke from his comatose state, which he had been in for many years. And the doctor had written him off many years ago. So they tried this medicine on a number of other people. And indeed, in a handful of cases, probably not more, people who had been in persistent vegetative state for prolonged periods of time were waking up with this Ambien. So here again, you know, this new literature is going to require halakhic analysis. As things progress. But what about the issue of nutrition and hydration? A very complex issue. I'm not going to read the case for you, but in essence, the question is, when are you required to provide nutrition and hydration, and what types of nutrition are there? There are different types of nutrition. The easiest, simplest form of nutrition for patients who are conscious is to take food by mouth. That's what you and I do, Baruch Hashem, we have that capability to do every day. But those who can't take by mouth, they can be delivered food in a number of different ways. This is a nasogastric tube, naso is nose, gastric is stomach. This is not a long-term solution for feeding. This is many patients in the hospital will receive a nasogastric tube. This is what's called a peg or a feeding tube, which is surgically implanted into the stomach, either by a general surgeon or by a gastroenterologist in a minor procedure. The shaila is, do you have to provide food in all circumstances, even if you have to do a minor surgical procedure to deliver that? So the basic gist of this, and this is my focus of the posting here, the basic gist of this is that, yes, actually more of a consensus than my focus, that you indeed have to provide food that is a basic requirement for all human beings at any stage of their life, that food is required to be delivered, even if it requires putting in a feeding tube, which is a relatively minor thing. Now, there is literature which is being produced in the medical world that shows that in very severely demented patients, feeding tubes don't necessarily prolong their lives any. So that literature will require analysis and may actually necessitate a different psych in limited circumstances. Here also, Rav Schechter has a slightly different approach to the feeding tubes than the other post teams. So, for example, and this underlies many of the approaches of Rav Schechter to end of life care, where he holds that the das rov b'nei adam is a valuable assessment of when it's permitted to withhold care and not withhold care. So, according to Schechter, if, for example, a person in 99% of people in this particular scenario would not want a feeding tube, then it would be halakhically okay to withhold the feeding tube. The majority of postmen do not concur with Rav Schechter on this, and they require feeding tubes under most circumstances. What about disconnecting a patient from the from life support? Here you have, do I have the patient's consent to switch off the life support system? So here, this is actually a common request in the hospital. And here, there's there is also a big debate among Republicans about when it's permitted to remove the respirator or not. The problem is, this relates directly to our discussion we had at the beginning about Nazi dying versus growing. So the respirator generally, and this here is the complex medical analysis, but not always is the respirator the sole perpetuation of this particular life. Not everybody who's on a respirator will die instantaneously if they are removed from a respirator, but many indeed will. So while it may be okay, according to Moshe, for example, to withhold certain treatments, so not to give certain antibiotics or not to give dialysis or people with kidney failure, it is not permitted ever, according to any codex, to actively hasten the death of the patient. The question is, if I remove the respirator, is that actively hastening the death of the patient? So most postings hold that this is a mafia dying, but it cannot stop the respirator. There's one posting of Chaim Dovid Halevi who held that the respirator is exactly akin to the Hasaras Monea of the Ramon. And he posited that it would be permitted to stop the respirator, because the respirator is just being a hockey to be an effort, and you can stop the respirator. Most of the postings don't concur with the sheet of Chaim Dovid Halevi. Having said that, there is a approach which to be resuscitated, if you will, which was mentioned by the Sicily Ezra a number of decades ago, about getting around the masabia dying and converting it to a grumma by hooking up respirators to timers, like a Shabbos clock, where the timer will go off at every certain interval, and you can reassess the patient, and if you think the patient needs to be restarted on the respirator, you can restart on the respirator. If not, not. This was introduced by Dr. Steinberg in Israel for his laws related to treatment at the end of life. Keep in mind, though, is it was introduced for the general public as sort of a compromise. But the Gedolia Post and Israel were not advocates of this timer and don't see it as a solution.
What about America?
I'm sorry?
So the
Gedolia Post. Okay, so the Post in America also are not fans of the timer. I don't know if they love it or catch it. It has advantages, essentially. Just so you know, from the secular world today, stopping the ventilator, when I started training, it was against the law to remove a patient from a respirator. You have to get a court order. Now it's my thing to call you in every single hospital. People are stopped, respirators are stopped all the time to allow patients to die in the hospital. Even I myself, I was at a case where they asked me, this patient came in, she was on the respirator, and the family wanted it to stop, so the doctor was sitting next to me, and she said, why don't you come into the ER, and Dr. Reisman, when you get into the ER, you can be at the bedside, Dr. Reisman will remove the respirator. As I said to her, I'm sorry, Dr. Reisman will not remove the respirator on this patient, you better call somebody else to do it. I'm going to hold off on questions.
Is respirator versus ventilator, what's the difference?
Synonym. Respirator, ventilator, life support, synonym. All
things.
So the same thing. Intubation is the procedure which they will then be hooked up to the respirator or the ventilator or the life support. Active euthanasia, so obviously anything which will hasten the death of the individual, happened to like this cartoon particularly. It was assisted suicide, but he was too big-headed to ask for it. Obviously we're not allowed to do any masabia dying in order to hasten the death of the individual. And here you have the classic parish of Sada Kabbalah and Pasuk of Bereishis. Pasuk is Achasim Chem Nashos Echem Egroish Miad Kol Chayav Yishenem Miad Hazcha Adam Miad Ish Achiv. What is this case of Lashem Miad Adam? I will exact punishment, and Miad Ish Achiv I will exact punishment. So he has a beautiful pshat. He said, there's two types of people that commit homicide. There's people who do it out of nekama. That's miyad ha'adam. Just the generic adam performs a murder in the course of a crime. And that's miyad ish achiv, also performs a murder. Somebody who is your brother, who loves you, who wants to end your life because you are in suffering, and the only reason they're doing it is because they're trying to do your tovah. So he says, the deal is, even that person is considered a rosei. Even someone who performs a murder for your benefit is roseach. So while it may be okay to withhold treatment, it's never okay to do masabia dying to perform rosiach. And I'll just, I think we'll just end here. And if you guys, just to conclude, we've covered a lot of issues that relate to the treatment of end of life. And again, I apologize, there's many issues we didn't have a chance to address. I put my email here, so you guys are more than welcome to contact me. with any questions about today or questions in general about medical health. And I hope that during the course of today's discussion, we've given you at least a little bit of understanding both of the medicine that's involved, the medical milieu in which we find ourselves functioning as physicians in our bodies, and will hopefully facilitate all of you to become great post-game